It was just about a year ago that we heard the news that white nose syndrome had been discovered in northeast Iowa, only about 30 miles from the Wisconsin border. While it's certainly cause for concern for our bat population, we're fortunate to have talented and committed biologists in the Department of Natural Resources working on the issue. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jennifer Riddell is a conservation biologist and cave and mine specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jennifer, great to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Paul White is a Wisconsin DNR conservation biologist with the BAT program as well. Paul, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
So we have, let's talk a little bit about Wisconsin's bats. And those that know me or have listened to the show know that I'm a really big fan of bats. So I was thrilled to be able to talk with you two today, especially coming up on Bat Fest that we want to make sure people have a chance to attend if they're able to. Let's talk about Wisconsin's bats, first of all. We have seven species of bats that regularly live in Wisconsin, right? Jennifer, which ones are those?
That's correct. We've got four species of cave bats, and those are the bats that hibernate over the wintertime, and those include the common bats that people see flying in their backyards, like big brown bats and little brown bats, but also a couple of less common species, the northern long-eared and eastern pipistrelle. And then we have three species of what are known as tree bats, and those are the migratory species that leave the state for our cold winters and go to warmer areas. And those bats have colorful fur. They're kind of large-bodied, tend to spend a lot of time alone. And so we have the hoary bat, the eastern red bat, and the silver-haired bat.
And I think most people, when they think of bats, they think of the ones that are in caves. But we could be walking by the ones that are on trees or other places and never notice them, right?
Correct. Especially this time of the year, bats are roosting during the daytime. And they're looking for a place that's safe from predators and also, of course, from human disturbance. And so that often means that they're maybe under some dead leaves on a tree or underneath the bark, but they might also be roosting behind your shutters or on the wall of a building or on your porch. So,
and if we do run into some of those bats, what should we do?
Best thing to do, of course, is always to just leave wildlife as you found it and leave it alone. Obviously, there's a very slim chance that a bat in the wild could carry rabies, and should you be bitten, that would not be a good thing. And so we, of course, don't want people handling bats in any way. So leaving them alone is the best
thing. And they'll probably move along on their own eventually, right?
They will. They're going to get themselves into a place that's safe and where they're comfortable.
Paul, do we have a sense of how many total number of bats might be living in Wisconsin?
We do a pretty good job in the winter of, since they all congregate in caves and mines, to do a complete population estimate. And we roughly estimate that it's anywhere from 275,000 to 300,000 bats, primarily little brown bats, so around 95%. But we do have three other species that occupy those hibernacula during the winter months.
And speaking of little brown bats, you brought a couple little visitors with, a little brown bat and a big brown bat. And Jennifer, what can you tell us about these bats?
We do have a few bats that we hold in captivity that are injured bats that were turned in for one reason or another and are non-releasable, but we're able to use those bats for public education. And so we do programs throughout the state at schools and for other related groups. And then, of course, we also have the Wisconsin Bat Festival coming up, where these bats and some of our other education bats, including bats that will be coming in from the Organization for Bat Conservation in Michigan, that will be used at the Bat Festival in programs, and people can see them up close and really get kind of nose-to-nose, especially with some of the non-native Wisconsin species. We have large fruit bats coming in from all over the world for that festival.
And they're, like you said, those more tropical bats are really stunning.
They're really impressive. Yeah. The largest bat in the world is the Malayan flying fox with a nearly 6-foot wingspan, and a bat named Camilla will be at the Bat Festival. And so you can see her, but there's going to be other species too, including, of course, our Wisconsin bats, but also vampire bats from Central and South America. So it's an exciting event.
I was fortunate to be practically nose to nose with a flying fox at the Nocturnal Zoo in Singapore. And it's a very low barrier zoo. So the flying fox was hanging upside down, uh-huh. eating fruit, you know, maybe a couple meters away from us. And at one point dropped down and flew over us. And like you said, a 6-foot wingspan. It was like, you know, your hair blows back. It's an incredibly powerful and beautiful animal.
Yeah, they do have a lot of power in those large wings. And I think, you know, a lot of folks, especially in Wisconsin, have maybe been close to a bat when it's gotten into their home or something and is sort of flying around trying to find its way outside again. But these larger fruit bats are really very calm. And when they're hanging, I think they're a little less scary to some people who might not want to be close to a flying bat with rapidly beating wings.
Well, and I think I remember you saying in the past that often those bats that do get inside are young bats that really, you know, don't know what to do. And so they are kind of frantic, but it's just because they're young and are got kind of turned around.
Yeah, it could be a young bat. There's a variety of reasons that bats get in, certainly if they're young, but also during the winter time, if a bat, like a big brown bat, for example, is trying to overwinter in someone's attic, they may make their way into the living space just while they're seeking out perhaps a warmer or more humid area to be. And so those bats do want to be outside. They don't want to be with people and they don't want to be enclosed. And so, of course, the thing to do is to stay calm. And if you can, open a window or a door and let the bat leave.
Does it matter if you keep the lights on or turn the lights off?
It really doesn't matter. You know, bats have great eyesight, but of course, they can also echolocate in mm-hmm. order to navigate in the dark.
And Paul, why are bats so important to healthy ecosystems in general? And specifically, what do they contribute in Wisconsin?
Well, if you think about just how many insects a bat can consume, just one single nursing bat, little brown bat in the summer, can consume anywhere from 500 to 1,000 mosquito-sized insects in an hour. In an hour. And so it can consume its body weight in insects in an evening. And if you consider that, so I'm 150 pounds. If I were to try and eat my weight in cheeseburgers, say quarter-pound cheeseburgers,
hoping you were going to eat that many mosquitoes. That would be a huge help, Paul.
But it would roughly be around 600 quarter-pound cheeseburgers if I would have to do that,
wow.
Just to compare that. But then every night. So, and it's a valuable asset to the landscape that we have, but then also to the agricultural industry, to the forestry industry, and obviously they take down mosquito pests and which have West Nile virus. But a recent study showed that it's anywhere from $658 million to $1.5 billion of added cost value that they have on the landscape to the agricultural industry. If you were to remove those bats from the landscape, you would have to apply pesticides to take care of the insects that are not being consumed mm-hmm. for free mm-hmm. By these bats. So they're definitely a valuable asset to the landscape.
I think that's a really important point because I know last year, it being so dry with the drought throughout the state, I was fortunate to be out on a bat mist netting outing with the two of you, and people were concerned that the bats didn't have enough to eat because mm-hmm. there were so few mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. And that was a great opportunity to talk about how it's not just mosquitoes, it's a whole variety of pests,
mm-hmm.
and not just pests that annoy us, but that actually damage crops and all kinds of things. So there was no worry about the bats starving last year.
Well, certainly, since the drought, you know, we did have reports of folks saying, hey, I used to have bats and I don't have them anymore, and it certainly could be because they had mm-hmm. a water source and it all of a sudden dried up and they had to go to a different area. So there might have been some starvation, but I suspect it was more concentrating the bats in different areas where there are water sources and an active food source.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Wisconsin's bat population with Paul White and Jennifer Riddell. They are conservation biologists with the Wisconsin DNR's BAT program. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and you can join the conversation. Are you a bat fan? Do you do anything to attract and support bats? Or maybe you'd like to know how to help and aren't sure what to do? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question or a comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Well, you know, we talked about the cave-dwelling bats, four of the seven in Wisconsin being cave-dwelling bats, and it's those cave-dwelling bats that are at risk for white-nose syndrome. Now, as we said, Jennifer, a year ago, we were just talking about that white-nose syndrome had been detected in Iowa. What's the update there, and what does it mean for Wisconsin?
Well, of course, each hibernation season that occurs, we unfortunately see this disease creep a little bit closer to our state's borders, in addition to filling in the gaps where the disease has been presently further in the east and down south in other states. We did see the disease move into southern Illinois, but also north-central Illinois this winter, and some more sites in Ontario came on the radar as well. So it's not something that we are pleased about, but certainly something we're expecting.
Has the spread been at about the rate that was predicted, or is it faster or slower?
We really haven't seen a change in the rate of spread. It's continuing to march onward. Mm-hmm. And little brown bats, for example, can fly as far as 250, 280 miles between a summer roost site or foraging area and their winter hibernation site. And we know that these bats move around during the fall swarm period when they're trying to find a place to hibernate for the winter and mating with other bats, socializing and going in and out of caves and from site to site. So certainly the disease is being spread during those times and can be spread at a certain rate because of that bat movement.
Let's back up and actually describe what white-nose syndrome is. What type of disease is it?
It's a fungal disease caused by a fungus, a cold-loving fungus called Geomyces destructans. And it first appeared in New York in 2006, and 2007 really started causing some noticeable problems. It attacks the bats during hibernation and only while they're hibernating. But this fungus actually causes skin damage and wing damage. So the fungus is present as a sort of fuzzy white mold on the hibernating bats. And for various reasons, including perhaps the fact that they have a suppressed immune system during hibernation, the fungus grows, damages the skin, and the bats are waking up that are sick. And normally a bat has retained enough fat to last it through 6 or 7 months of winter hibernation. Of course, these are insect-eating bats, and there's no food on the winter landscape for them. And when they wake up every 2 or 3 days, they're burning through 30 to 60 days worth of hibernation body fat that they would normally need to survive that long winter. So within a very short time, they're burning through their fat reserves, dying in situ or moving to the cave entrance or out onto the landscape in search of food and perhaps water and dying there.
So basically, it causes them to starve.
More correct. Okay. We know that the dead bats have low body weight and are dehydrated.
And so the detection in Iowa, if I remember correctly, was not actually a visual detection. It was that the DNA was present. Has there been a more obvious sign of white nose in Iowa, Paul?
No, we actually haven't seen anything progress in that state. So that's been a good thing. It seems that that has kind of calmed. But we did find the genetic evidence. And so it wasn't actually full-blown white-nose syndrome that we did find or that officials found in Illinois, which is definitely of concern to us. And that's, you know, roughly 100 miles from our closest hibernation site. So we're certainly concerned with that. It's spread to 22 states and 5 Canadian provinces, so it's at our doorstep. And, you know, we've been saying this for the last 3 years that we expect to find it. And luckily, through our hibernation surveillance, we haven't found it, but we certainly expect it within the next couple of years.
We're talking about Wisconsin's bats with Jennifer Riddell and Paul White from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bat Program. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stay with us. I hope you'll stay tuned, because today at 11:45, biologist Daphne Fairbairn joins us to talk about her really fascinating book, Odd Couples, Extraordinary Difference Between the Sexes in the Animal Kingdom. And right now we are talking about bats with Jennifer Riddell and Paul White from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bat Program. And let's go to the phones, because we have quite a few people waiting to join the conversation. Simon in Madison is first. Hi, Simon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I guess I have kind of a two-part question for your guests. The first is, with this fungal infection, is it the kind of thing that once it hits an area or once it infects a colony or a cave, that it's going to stick around for years or decades and kind of keep that colony at a much lower population level? Or is it the kind of thing that kind of spreads through and then passes on? And then kind of related to that, I'm also wondering, if the disease were to go away, but the bat population was severely reduced, how long would it take the bat population to rebound to its normal levels? Thanks.
Great, Simon. Thanks for those questions. Jennifer, what are you seeing in, for instance, out east where it started much earlier? Does the fungus stay in those locations?
It does. And in fact, a lot of the work on this disease has been done right here in Madison at the USGS National Wildlife Health Center. And they have done work on the persistence of the fungus in cave and mine environments. Number one, we know that if we put healthy bats into a previously affected cave or mine, they will contract the disease. And USGS has also done some testing of sediments now from previously affected sites where all of the bats have been killed off. And they are finding that the fungus does persist in sediments for at least months past the time that bats.
So it's not necessarily bat to bat. It can be bat in a location
bat
and then
cave.
Location to bat.
Yeah, cave to bat. And then potentially, of course, the fact that humans occasionally visit sites, including biologists and cavers, we want to make sure that folks are taking time to appropriately clean and disinfect any shoes or clothing or other items that enter cave environments because of that.
So basically, once a cave or a mine is infected, there's no guarantee that it'll ever be clean again.
Correct.
So Simon's question about, if a place is infected and the bats are infected, how long would it take to rebound after that? But we're not sure that there's an after that, right, Paul?
No, we're not. I mean, when we're talking 70 to 90, even upwards of 100% mortality of these sites where we have historic evidence of bats using that site for years on average. And so 20,000 bats using this site for over 20 years, and all of a sudden white nose sweeps through, and we find that the next year that's 100 bats, and the next year after that it's 20, and the next year after that it could be zero. So it's going to take a long time for these bats to rebound. They typically only have one young per year. They're not like mice where they could be grandparents by the end of the year. Bats only, very long-lived, but they do only have one young per year. So it's going to take a long time for these bats to rebound, and especially when you have the way that they hibernate, they're all concentrated in one area and could sweep through and wipe out a large population of bats in a small period of time.
Has there been any evidence? It sounds like pretty much all cave-dwelling bats are susceptible, but have there been any cases where it seems like a particular group of bats or even just some individuals seem resistant in some way?
We haven't found any resistance, and there's certainly been talk of that, and that's, people want to hang on to hope, certainly. But at the moment, we haven't found any type of resistance. Right now, out east, they're trying to figure out if the individuals that are coming back to these sites that have been infected for a long time, are those resistant individuals, or are those just new individuals coming back? So there's certainly a strong sense of trying to figure that out. Big brown bats, we know that they are not as affected, just because of the microclimates that they choose in the site. And they're the ones that if somebody calls me up in the middle of winter and says, hey, I got a hibernating bat in my attic or in my basement, that's the bat that we're most likely to see there. So they don't have the mortality that the other three species do. But right now, Milu, our little brown bat, that's what I call it, they're the ones that will be the hardest hit by white nose syndrome. Mm.
Well, speaking of bats in houses, I think Hannah in Northern Door County might have a question about that. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We live on a family farm in Northern Door County, and we live right along the Niagara Escarpment. It's a beautiful place. We have a big bluff on the family farm. But we do have an overabundance of bats, a large number of bats, and we talked about over the years having them removed, but how do we go about removing bats so they're not such a nuisance? For example, we really can't sit out on our deck in the evening. There's just so many. And my second question is, we've noticed over the years, we've seen several times some They look like light silver or white small bats. And we just were wondering what those were. We'd never seen them before. So those are my questions.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Hannah. And just so you know, I would be happy to sit out on that deck and watch all those bats. That's my idea of a good time. But, Paul, what would you say?
Did you say that it was a barn that they were roosting in?
Well, we do have several large outbuildings. We have a large barn and large granary and some other smaller outbuildings. Our house is probably, you know, 2 football fields away from the barn area. But they're even near our home, that far away from the barn. And, you know, there's just a huge number of them at night, especially if we turn on the yard lights. Then there's a lot of them, of course, looking for mosquitoes.
I was going to say, I think they're following the mosquitoes.
Right, and so mosquitoes are attracted to you, and the bats are attracted to the mosquitoes. So what maybe seemingly is bats swooping down next to you is just them predating on the insects that are attracted to you. So like Judith said, I would be happy to have that, but I understand.
Paul and I will be up this weekend.
Right. If it was a barn, it's challenging to remove bats because they are such a porous building and they're often very old. But if it's an attic, it's certainly something that you can deal with. And you just have to find out where they're coming and going, where their entrances are. And it could be as simple as sitting out at night, you know, right at sunset. Usually they all exit right around 10 to 15 minutes after sunset, and they come pouring out of the entrances that they find in there. And it could be anything from a quarter to a half an inch that they can exploit. And they're certainly not going to make a hole, but they're going to exploit anything that's open. So finding out where those entrances are and then putting those one-way doors up, which is commonly called a bat valve, which allows the bats to leave but not come back in, that's your best bet on your home. But there is a non-exclusion period from June 1st through August 15th, and that's to protect the young ones so the mothers don't leave and then they can't get back in. So there is a non-exclusion period which you have to abide by. But if you're not willing to do it yourself, we have there's bat professionals out there, and I would just Google, you know, bat excluders. We tend to stay away from the folks that kind of do general pest control, just because the folks that deal with specifically with bats know what needs to be done to take care of the individuals that are coming and going out of your home.
Thanks for that call. And, you know, let's talk a little, let's reiterate actually that June 1st to, was it August 15th?
August 15th, yeah.
Is off limits for getting rid of bats because of that roosting period. But so if it's, say, June 2nd, mm-hmm. and someone finds that there are bats have taken up residence in their attic or, you know, something like that, what's the best thing to do? Is it just to leave them be, or what if there's a concern, you know?
Every situation is different. There are exceptions to the rule, of course. If it's a daycare center, if it's a hospital, if it's a nursing home, those individuals or those places actually have an exemption, and we work with them on a case-by-case basis. If somebody calls up frantically saying, hey, it's June 2nd, and I've got bats in my home, and I think it's a health risk, then we can work with those individuals and try and set them up with a bat professional that'll remove them, or we can give them guidelines on how to do it. But we're trying to protect the bats and mitigate any kind of unnecessary mortality. So, as long as they call us, and we actually have a bat hotline, and it's 266 or 608-266-5216. And if they have any questions or comments or, you know, want more information, call that number, leave a Great. Message, and we usually respond within 24 hours. It depends on field season, but we try and respond as fast as Great. Possible. And
again, that's 608-266-5216 mm-hmm. is the bat hotline. Not to call Batman, but to call the bat people. And just to be clear, I mean, when we're talking about having someone come out and remove bats, the goal is to remove the bats and keep them alive so that they can go and find a more appropriate place.
Oh, right.
Right.
Yeah.
So, just so people know that we're not talking about, exterminators mm-hmm. coming
in. And they're usually not even physically handling the bats. It's identifying the holes that are in the structure and putting these one-way doors up, allowing the bats to leave and not come back. And so they're not handling the bats in any way. And there really shouldn't be any reason to, unless maybe a rogue bat had flown inside the living space and they can't get it out. Mm-hmm. And the bat professional just happened to be there. He's rabies vaccinated, and they would take care of that individual.
Great. Just want to make sure people know we're trying to keep everybody happy and healthy. Mm-hmm. Let's go to David in Raymond next. Hi, David.
Good morning. Interesting topic. I guess my question is the exact opposite of the previous caller. How do I attract bats? About 4 years ago, I built a bat house stuck up on the side of my barn wanting to get rid of mosquitoes, and I haven't seen one bat. It's up high. It's on the south side of the barn.
Usually we say location, location, location. So it sounds, I mean, from everything you've said, that's exactly what we recommend. About how high is it?
20 feet.
20 feet, perfect. And how close are you to water?
The neighbor has a good-sized pond next to us back in his field, so there's a fair amount of water.
Okay, because usually we say within a quarter mile you're going to have a higher chance of getting bats to occupy an artificial roosting site. So potentially what you could do is send us a picture of the bat house. We can identify, you know, maybe something that you might need to tweak. But, you know, they like a clean house. They want to make sure that it's not wet inside at any point. So when we build our bat houses, we caulk all the seams and make sure that there isn't any condensation that could potentially get in, because they like a nice dry house. And so we actually have a bat roost monitoring program that people can go outside, and if they have an artificial box, a bat box, they can watch bats come out. Or if they are like Hannah in Door County and they want to watch bats come out of their barn but not in their attic,
right,
that's fine.
Right.
But we actually have quite a crew of volunteers that go out and count bats throughout the summer. Last year we counted over 20,000 bats.
Wow.
Just by volunteers. So I would recommend to either call that bat hotline or look up how to contact us, and we can try and provide more information on the best way to get bats in your barn. But it does sound like you're doing the right things, and oftentimes it takes 2 to 3 to 4 years just for the bats to find it. And it's a challenge for sure.
Thanks for that call, David. We are talking with Jennifer Riddell and Paul White from the Bat Program of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And two different points came up there, talking about bat houses, which I have to say, I had a bat house up for a few years, and all I ever got was wasps that moved in, which was not very exciting. But we did some construction, and I had to take it down, and so now I want to put it back up, and hopefully I'll get the right inhabitants this time. But we talked about bat houses, and we also talked about monitoring, and both of those tie into Bat Fest, which is coming up on June 1st and is a great event. I was there last year volunteering and looking at the bats. Jennifer, why don't you give us a rundown of what kind of activities are going on? This is at Warner Park Community Center in Madison, on the north side of Madison.
That's correct. So Saturday, June 1st at Warner Park, from 10 in the morning until actually 10 into the evening, we'll have bat activities of all kinds going on all day. And it's a super exciting event. I mentioned earlier, we will have live bats there from Wisconsin, but also from all over the world. So there's a professional educator, Rob Myers, from the Organization for Bat Conservation in Michigan, who has a variety of species, including vampire bats, who will be on hand, and he'll be doing live programming at various times throughout the day. And I'm really excited this year. We have an excellent lineup of speakers for some concurrent science and monitoring sessions that students in particular may be interested in, but the general public as well. We have folks from the USGS National Wildlife Health Center who work with the disease, white nose syndrome, who will be presenting, and also professors from various universities, colleges in the area, who will talk about bat monitoring efforts going on in their part of Wisconsin. And in addition to all of this wonderful education and programming and entertainment with live bats, we've got a lot of kids' activities. There's a giant inflatable bat cave that kids can explore. We have places to try your hand at what it's like to be a bat. And we also have a raffle. The whole event is not only educational, but also a fundraiser for the Wisconsin Bat Conservation Fund. And so at night this year, we have something new, and that's kind of special, Bat Science Night from 7 to 10. And that will be outside at Warner Park. And we will not only have the inflatable cave and some try your hand at mist netting activities for kids, but we will actually be mist netting for live bats, the wild bats of Warner Park. And also listening to live bat acoustic calls and getting to not only hear those calls, but to watch them projected in sonogram form live on a screen. So we'll be working with folks and having them help us and showing them what we do on a typical night in the field in the summer.
Which I have to say, I got to go along last year, and it's an amazing experience. And so to have it as part of BatFest is such a great idea. And I know, Jennifer, you said that you guys did some mist netting, and mist nets are just very, very fine nets so that the bats don't necessarily see them.
Correct.
Or sense them, so they end up in the nets. But you did kind of a trial run out at Warner Park, was it last week?
We did some monitoring last week and had really excellent bat activity. There were hundreds of bats flying low across the lagoon at Warner Park at sunset, so it's not only a really beautiful experience, but they're taking care of eating insects. And then did get to capture a handful of bats for monitoring purposes. But if it's anything like it was last week and the weather is good, Bat Science Night will not be a disappointment to people that come out for that.
And Paul, I know you do a lot with the acoustic monitoring of bats, and you train people to be volunteer monitors. What does that entail?
Right. And so actually I have two trainings coming up this week. I'm going to Sheboygan and Manitowoc because they are getting new systems. And so we have an acoustic monitoring device that detects their ultrasound. All bats in Wisconsin echolocate and they use ultrasound. Anything above the sound of human hearing is considered ultrasound. And so these bats are echolocating and we use equipment that we can actually hear. It brings it down into our human hearing range. And I think you actually have some calls,
yes.
But we can play those in just a moment. But I train folks and usually around an hour and a half, and we take them on a bat walk. And people are just so enlightened by the experience because normally they would just walk around in the evening, whether it's their favorite state natural area or just an urban environment, and not hear these bats. And all of a sudden you have the ability to hear them, and we have a small PDA, which is just a screen that you can see the bat calls going by, and each different species has their different character signature. And so we can actually figure out which bats are in the area just based on not only hearing them, but then you can see them on the call. And that's really important because it's not only a white nose surveillance tool, because we can figure out, hey, it looks like there's quite a bit of abundance in the Madison area, and then all of a sudden, maybe white nose swept through and we're noticing that it's lower abundance now. But it does give us new information on areas where we just didn't have any bat information. And so, Northwest Wisconsin, we're kind of lacking in that area. All of a sudden, you bring an acoustic detector up there for a couple of nights, and within a couple of nights, you can figure out what species are using that property and in what relative abundance. So it's a really fun way to get out there, and we've got a great group of folks that, it's over 500 people so far that have done an acoustic survey. Just last year, we had over 500 surveys turned in. It's a pretty automated system. To date, we've had over 2,000 surveys in all 72 counties. So it's really been a fun effort, and to get folks trained is a good thing. So,
well, let's listen to a couple of those calls because they are amazingly different from each other. I mean, when I first heard them, I thought, you're going to have a trained ear. Not that I could say, oh, that's a red bat, but they sound very different from each other. So actually, let's listen first to a red bat feeding. So, Paul, what did you hear in that?
Well, I heard a happy red bat, because in the middle there, that little zip
sounds like a zipper going
up.
Yep,
it just ate, either a mosquito or typically red bats eat moths. So a moth had met his demise. And, the neat thing about that is it was so quick, and it was maybe only a 3 to 4 second clip, but it ate during the middle of that and went right back
to
feeding again.
There was no pause.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably talking with its mouth full as it's flying at that point. So it's a really neat experience. And you notice that one was very chirpy. If you play the next one, you're going to notice that it's going to be a very different cadence, and it's going to be a lower frequency bat, and so that's how we can differentiate the different species.
Okay, so this is the hoary bat, the roar of the hoary. I have to say that one always sounds like a tap dance routine to me. It's got that nice little syncopation to it. So why is that so different then from the red bat?
Well, they use a different frequency, or at least a lower frequency. And so their sound pulses are sending much farther, and they're looking for different insects. And they often are found in different habitats than the eastern red bats. So it just depends on the habitat, depends on what prey base they're actually searching for at that moment. But yeah, different species, different call recordings.
So you were saying that the red bat was probably eating a moth. What most likely was the hoary after?
Well, there's actually been evidence of them eating Luna moths, but then also the eastern pipistrelle, which is our smallest bat, and if you can think of a pinky finger, it's about the size of that, and supposedly there's been a record of them predating on the eastern pipistrelle.
Oh, really?
So they eat a wide variety of things, but beetles, hard-shelled beetles, they definitely have the mouth structure to be able to bite down on those individuals. So they eat actually quite a variety of insects.
Well, we have just a few minutes left, and I want to make sure that we let people know other ways that they can get involved. We talked about the Bat Fest on June 1st, and we do have a link to the Bat program, but also then a comment that links to Bat Fest on the Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show. Can people call the Bat Hotline, or would it be better to call somewhere else to get information about Bat Fest?
Actually, you could call the Bat Hotline, but we have a lot of information right on our website.
Okay.
So we should have a final speaker schedule up within the next week or so. So if you're thinking about coming down to attend one of the various talks at a specific time, you can see that, as well as get all of the other information. By the way, it's $5 for adults, and kids under 16 are free.
And that covers both the science night.
Correct.
And Bat Fest during
the day. That's the cost for the festival, and Bat Science Night is included.
And then there's also a special event the night before.
There is. We're trying to raise money for our program within the Bureau of Endangered Resources. Most of our program's funding just comes from gifts and grants. And so if folks donate directly to the Bureau of Endangered Resources Bat Program, the state matches those donations dollar for dollar, and we're able to receive some extra funds that way. And those funds are really for on-the-ground work that we're doing right now, and the work that we're doing to establish baseline data and also to prepare for white nose syndrome is really critical at this time.
And Paul, if people want to get involved in volunteer monitoring, would you be the person to contact?
Mm-hmm.
How can they get in touch with you?
DNR Bats. DNR Bats at Wisconsin.gov would be the easiest way. And then that goes to a general email, and then that can be siphoned to me. But my first name is John, and so it's kind of an interesting email. So let's just go.
You're hiding behind Paul.
DNR Bats at Wisconsin.gov is the easiest way, and it can go to the appropriate people.
All right. Well, Jennifer Riddell and Paul White, thanks so much for spending time with us today. Always fun to see you and to see the bats and to talk about our bats.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We'll see you at the Bat Festival.
Yes, definitely. And coming up next, we're going to be talking with Daphne Fairbairn about her book, which is Odd Couples. It talks about the differences between males and females throughout the animal kingdom. It's a fascinating book, and I think you'll enjoy hearing from Daphne. Stay tuned.